You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. This is being recorded on June 1st, 2025. I have no idea where May went. I'm thinking it's like May 15th or something. This month absolutely flew by. But I think part of the reason is I'm working on so many papers, two books. You know, I asked for donations and assistance for this very reason, and today's topic is a very difficult one, intellectually speaking. And I can't believe it's taken this long to get to it. It gets mentioned quite a bit, but it is not easy reading, so it doesn't get talked about very much. Karl Marx's famous very early essay on the Jewish question, which came out in 1844, Zur Judenfrage. Marxism, like it or not, has always been a Jewish movement, in some places exclusively so. It makes the present, you know, this essay, this discussion, it's very hard to interpret. This was very early in Karl Marx's career, 5 years before the Manifesto was published. And it's infamous on the left. Some of what he says about the Jews is quite accurate. The spirit in which he says it is a separate issue. So as postmodern socialism and leftism is vehemently against any kind of anti-Semitism, the Jewish question sticks out like a huge problem for them. It's either ignored or condemned. Karl Marx, as we all know, was a Jew, grandson of a rabbi. He was well aware of the role of his people in the creation of revolution long before socialism. It's important to know the role of capitalism and free trade as necessary precursors for any future socialist revolution, in the sense it destroys religion, ethnicity, tradition, the guilds. The Jewish mentality created the mercantile spirit, the capitalist spirit. But that's only one stage in the revolutionary drama. They will take over totally in the socialist revolution. So the point of the Jewish question, which he actually wrote in 1843, published in 1844, the point was to stress the Jewish role in bringing mercantile life to the apex of society, making it something respectable. Now, if you go through the literature, the secondary literature on this essay, it has overwhelmingly been dominated by Jews, which is a problem right off the bat, because their interpretations are almost all the time, a laughable parody of scholarship. I'm talking about academia. Their writings on this topic are self-serving, they're distorted, and they're protected from ever having to answer the question as to whether or not Marx's characterization, regardless of the spirit in which he stated these things, was true or false. Marxism is one of the official ideologies of the Western European University, the American University, so it has to be cleansed of any association with retrograde ideas. So this, again, this essay is a bit of a problem. Now, what is his aim here? You know, the difficulty of this paper, it deals with phenomenology. There is no superficial way of getting around the difficulty here. It's about the concepts of emancipation. I put that in big quotes. Was he defending the full civil and political emancipation of Germany's Jews? Now, that's a weird thing to say, since Jews didn't consider themselves Germans. They didn't speak German. And saw the population around them as goyim, or cattle, to be exploited. Of course, like everywhere they went, Jews were a highly privileged and wealthy minority. and this mostly concerns pre-unification Germany. So emancipation is a bit of a contrived discussion. Emancipation in reality really means that Jews being far better organized and operating from a different moral playbook in terms of finance and competition, having more money would rule society entirely, creating it or turning it into a mass of animals, as Moses Hess put it. Now, the target of this essay is a response to something of the same title, by the way, written by the weirdo atheist Bruno Bauer, who, by the way, is not Jewish, although I thought he was for the longest time. 1 year prior to this essay, he wrote The Jewish Question, and he argued, strangely, he argued that Jews had to somehow give up their Judaism if they were ever to become worthy of equal rights. That's how Hal Draper put it. But of course, that all turns on what the word Judaism means. By itself, it doesn't mean anything. It could refer to a culture, an ethnicity, or a religion. I mean, some of the more naive Gentile writers still think it's just a different church that they go to. But let's face it, the religious aspects of the group are certainly secondary to their ethnic cohesion. Judaism is a rejection of logos. Bauer's problem is that he saw Judaism as a religion. Marx's view, Bauer's initial error, was his failure to distinguish between political and what he called human emancipation. Two different things. Human emancipation is revolution. Political emancipation, I mean, Bauer was not a Marxist or a socialist, of course. Political emancipation in the modern state doesn't require Jews to renounce anything. It would just remove any legal restrictions on their behavior. Only a complete and revolutionary so-called human emancipation, but that would just involve the disappearance of religion and ethnicity completely. And of course, given the time period, that wasn't possible. But we all know what Lenin would do with that, what that would mean in practice. The Orthodox Church was slaughtered in the most violent and systemic way imaginable. So according to Marx, Bauer didn't make a distinction between those two. Political emancipation was the simple removal of restraint. It didn't require the abolition of religion any more than it would require the abolition of anything else, like private property or the right to vote. Now, when we say things like private, you know, the modern political state liberated those conditions from political control, thus allowing them to flourish in private life. But by private, we're talking about private sector, that is, outside of the state, what Hegel would call civil society, the market. In Hegel's view, I've talked about this before, Bauer was a Hegelian, Marx was kind of a Hegelian. State and civil society are two different worlds, the latter finding its completion in the former. It was only when a state, by the way, a term used equivocally here, in Marx's very early view, would absorb civil society into itself, could the start of any kind of human emancipation take place. Of course, that's what revolution means in his mind. Both Hegel and Marx, though, believe that a state separate from civil society, that is, economic relations, that in and of itself is a form of alienation. I want to quote, there's going to be a lot of quotes here. This is the first quote from Karl Marx in The Jewish Question. The decomposition of man into Jew and citizen, Protestant and citizen, religious man and citizen, is neither a deception directed against citizenship, nor is it a circumvention of political emancipation. It is political emancipation itself, the political method of emancipating oneself from religion. Of course, in periods where the political state, as such, is born violently out of civil society, when political liberation is the form in which men strive to achieve their liberation, the state can and must go so far as to abolish religion, the destruction of religion. but I can only do so in the same way that it proceeds to the abolition of private property, to the maximum, confiscation, progressive taxation, just as it goes far in the abolition of life, the guillotine. Well, upon political emancipation, Jews will dominate through money. Their role is in civil society, the market. After the revolution, there will be no alienated individuals with their own privatized religious point of view. But it also means that Jewish economic practices, in this case, will not be restricted. Now, Karl Marx's main teacher was Ludwig Feuerbach. And his atheism essentially was that religion is a human construct that reflects human conditions. Marx saw religion as an expression of suffering and a protest against it. Marx wrote in 1843 his critique of Hegel's philosophy of right. Marx opposed some of the young Hegelians like Bauer, who focused on the Jews as a religion rather than an ethnic group. And it really couldn't be a solution to any kind of suffering without what he calls a transformative critique of society. When you take that out of intellectual terms, that's revolution. It's mass violence. A critique of religion would be ineffective without changing the real conditions of which religion is only an expression. Infamously, Marx wrote, "Religious suffering is, at one and the same time, the expression of real suffering and a protest against real suffering. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, and the soul of a soulless condition. It is the opium of the people." I always like to put that in some kind of context there. What that really all means is that the violent abolition of religion, the illusory happiness of a people, Karl Marx sees this as their demand for real happiness, somehow giving socialism its mandate. Socialism calls on them to give up their illusions about their condition. It calls on them to give up the condition that requires illusions. And that became the justification for Jewish mass murders in the USSR. Now, the key element here is free trade, where the Jews dominated, especially from Britain. Marx was a devotee of free trade because it destroyed national boundaries. It created an alienated proletariat, really without a country, in his mind. At the time, there was a movement in Germany going back to the early 19th century with Fichte, Liszt, Herder. Marx believed that it was backward to advocate tariffs because tariffs were advocated in German society to preserve German or Prussian sovereignty. The French and British revolutions abolished the restraints on man's passions that Christianity created. It means that these bourgeois revolutions allowed the rapacious capitalists to gain the upper hand and oppress the poor in a way unknown when Christianity was the source of the social order, as E. Michael Jones wrote in 2014. By the time Zur Judaean Frage was written, the evils of capitalism, the factory system, were too great to ignore. It was indefensible. Still, Marx was a young man. His ideology had not reached its full coherence. But he kind of exploded onto the scene. He was able to do this with Rothschild money, as Bakunin, we'll get to that much later. And this is part of the reason why when you say socialism, people think Marxism right away, that somehow Marxism is the only alternative to capitalism. Prior to that, the Christian and idealist socialism or the corporatism was found in ethno-nationalism. Because of the sickening economic conditions in the West, you have, you know, benighted people dusting off library copies of Capital because they've been told that Marx is the only alternative to capitalism, and somehow the two systems are opposite. Why did Marx talk about the proletariat? Now, that's an abstraction. I've argued for many years now that Karl Marx personally, as well as later socialism, especially in the USSR, had absolutely nothing to do with labor or the workers. The proletariat was chosen because, and they were supposed to be able to bring about the dissolution of the existing social order, because they were so deeply alienated. The opposite of that, economic nationalism, List, Herder, Mueller, Fichte in Germany, the monarchy and Slavophiles in Russia, would try to preserve that order from what was known at the time as predatory British free trade. But the proletariat as a sociological group derives from those who have left the village to find work in the growing cities during and after the Industrial Revolution. They were often alone, alienated, surrounded by new temptations, and cut off from everything that made them human. He owned nothing, so the only thing he could do was rent his own body out as a worker. This level of alienation Marx wanted for all of humanity, since it was necessary for the socialist revolution to take place. Men with a strong sense of ethnicity and religion do not fight for socialism. We're talking about two revolutions. English Protestant capitalism was the revolution, and you see it in the Jacobins in France. This empowered the bourgeoisie. Karl Marx saw the proletariat as the vanguard of his movement because it was an abstraction. I've talked about how these words are so destroyed in Soviet practice. They could be whatever they wanted to project onto the so-called working class, they can do. But in practical terms, their level of alienation made them the perfect candidate. But even that failed for the most part. Remember, Marxism, socialism had nothing to do with their well-being. It was only that they were vulnerable and quite possibly easy to organize. But because of Marx and his financing with the Rothschilds, any reaction, or the reaction against British capitalism, was socialism, and it also was Jewish, which also meant that it possessed a visceral hatred of Christianity. The problem that the socialists didn't understand, or they understood they didn't want to deal with it, it was the Christian moral order that prevented the Darwinian domination of the rich over the poor in the first place. So in the Jewish question, Marx, and this is a very, very infamous statement, what is the worldly cult of the Jew? Huckstering. What is his worldly god? Money. Now, that's nice as far as it goes, but what it really means is that Marx then conferred on the proletarian the very same mindless identity, a rootless cipher with no homeland. Engels was aware that the first and most obvious result of the emancipation of the Christian order was the exploitation of the poor by the rich. The rich had now been emancipated from any duty towards labor. Marx, taking from his other teacher, Moses Hess, was convinced that the destruction of Christianity would lead to a future paradise, the ultimate Jewish fantasy, tikkun olam, healing the world. Now, of course, Karl Marx didn't believe anything literally in the Jewish religion, such that it was a revolution, religion at all. He saw it as just a spiritual reflection of Jewish economic life. And in that regard, I agree with him. Certainly, the religious elements of Judaism are radically secondary to its ethnic component. Now, this is a complex argument. There was a historical choice created the Jew as a financially able huckster. It posits the connection between Judaism as a religion and the economy of the bourgeois world. Marx supported free trade precisely because it would increase the misery of the worker. And here's what he said. Generally speaking, the protective system, meaning tariffs, and these days is conservatives, while the free trade system works destructively. It breaks up old nationalities and carries antagonism of proletarian and bourgeoisie to the uttermost point. In a word, the free trade system hastens the social revolution. In the revolutionary sense alone, gentlemen, I'm in favor of free trade. So, in order to emancipate the working class as human beings, Marx had to destroy whatever was left of the Christian order, or of anything concerning natural law, private property, the family, religion, and most certainly, ethnicity and race. Now, Engels mentioned this too. I'm quoting from, the quote is from Baron Metal, but it's from Frederick Engels. He says, "The great mass of proletarians are, by their very nature, free from national prejudices, and on their whole disposition and movement, essentially humanitarian, anti-nationalist. Only the proletarians can destroy nationality. Only the awakening proletariat can bring about fraternization between the different nations." Now, that's, again, something that he simply projected onto this mythic working class. But this is what the Jewish question, as an essay, was arguing. Because Jews monopolize the academic writing on this topic, they can't see it. They're blinded by ethnic self-interest. One of the worst offenders here is Hal Draper, who, of course, is a Jew, who doesn't seem to know what's going on. He says, and he's talking about Bauer here, not Marx. Bauer's core argument, as long as Jews remain Jewish, they are too consumed by Jewish self-interest and communalism to be worthy of full citizenship. In effect, Bauer was calling for opposition to the nascent movement for Jewish emancipation in Germany. His lengthy essay was replete with anti-Semitic themes. If Jews were ill-treated in the Christian world, they provoked this mistreatment by their obstinacy. Jews were not hated because they were misunderstood, since true understanding ought to lead to hatred. Jews had lost interest in the progress of man and concentrated entirely on personal advantage. Jews had evolved no moral principle from their suffering, etc. Now, Bauer was just describing the present state of Jews in Germany. Even the concept of citizenship was it was a matter of alienation. Now, Draper might have convinced himself that all of what Bauer was saying, or even Marx was saying, was anti-Semitic, but it's not contrary to historical truth. Jews were poorly treated from time to time in Christian society due to usury, monopoly, their control over the alcohol trade, and we'll get to it in a minute, underselling in business. That's not my personal opinion. That's how it is. I want to continue with Draper because he represents the literature in this field to a great extent. He completely mutilates Marx's meaning. While Bauer echoed the generally prejudicial representation of the Jew as merchant and the money man, Marx's response was that in the modern world, money has become a world power, and the practical spirit of the Jews has become the practical spirit of Christian people. In other words, why pick on the Jews? The practical spirit of Judaism is money-making, as Bauer suggests. This hardly distinguishes Jews from the great array of non-Jewish entrepreneurs, merchants, and bankers who have risen to ascendancy in contemporary society. The idea that the Jew is fundamentally more rooted in money-making than the Christian is wrong-headed, as the idea that Jew is less eligible for civil and political rights. Historically, it is true that many Jews played a significant role as middlemen between landowners and tenants, state taxpayers, capital consumers, and that a few Jews, like the Rothschild family, played a significant role as international bankers. But Marx insisted that this progressive role played by Jews in the development of capitalism was coming to an end, and the practical spirit of money-making was as general as the growth of nation-states, national banks, and national capital. Now, there's a lot of confusion in what he wrote here. And again, he speaks for a lot of the literature on this topic. Jews created the modern commercial state. No matter what city or region you analyze during the Renaissance or after the Renaissance, Jews came to control a massive share of its mercantile trade, using debt to take large chunks of property themselves. For him to call this prejudicial is laughable. It was quite the opposite. It had been the direct experience of millions from Spain to Russia. The Derzhavin Commission alone proves that. That discovered the real reason for peasant unrest in Western Russia. International banking was the Rothschild family. Pretending that they were just one of many is dishonest. But it also means that any Marxist, or any socialist, I should say, would have to look very closely at Jewish capital, since so much of it was concentrated and under their control. But because socialism was Jewish, that became impossible. So the Jewish religion, quote-unquote, doesn't need to disappear in society like Bauer argues, because it's a natural part of it. But that makes sense only if by religion he means the economic and ethnic existence of predatory Talmudism. Marx equated practical Judaism with huckstering and money. Then he concludes that Christians have become Jews. And ultimately, it is mankind, both Christians and Jews, that needs to emancipate itself from this practical Judaism. But Marx was also just reflecting reality. Christians, in this sense, are Protestants, especially the Puritans, the Calvinists. In other words, it's just another way of saying that Jews leverage their financial power to alter the basic moral code of the societies in which they lived. They were the revolutionary core, whether capitalist or socialist. Dishonest business tactics forced Gentiles to respond in kind until the society became a commercial one, not a moral one. It's not a prejudice. It's a fact. Jews have been removed from 109 cities, nations, or empires since the fall of Rome. What's remarkable about that is the consistency of the reason, dishonest huckstering. Without exception, there's always other things, but that's the main one. Draper says, and I don't think he fully understands the meaning of this, there is no longer any economic basis for distinguishing between Jew and Gentile, hence no room for legal discrimination between them. I think what he's missing is that the Judaization of society has enabled the Jews to emancipate themselves in a Jewish way. And in practicality, all that remains is put the official stamp of legality on this. But the key element is that the Jews created this present situation. In other words, they bought their emancipation. It's really a very contrived debate. But any persecution which derives directly from Jewish behavior would also benefit them, so long as it didn't go too far, since it would just give even greater impetus to their cohesion, which is their ultimate weapon. So at any given time, some persecution is absolutely necessary for modern Judaism. All the restrictions on Jews in Europe came from their own behavior. First, it was dishonest business. Then it was violent revolutionary action. If you've been following the discussion on Solzhenitsyn's 200 Years together, you know what I'm talking about. What was initially a differential treatment of Jews and non-Jews in commercial law eventually became the complete transformation of the idea of commerce towards free trade. Jews can charge interest to strangers, that is, goyim, but not to each other. That means that the modern profit-seeking egoism derives in part from the Jewish conception of their law concerning non-Jews. Intercourse with strangers cannot but loosen the bonds of personal duties and replace them by economic freedom. Freedom in quotes. Such a mentality was entirely foreign to Christian Europe and the Middle Ages, and yet that, of course, has escaped Jewish writers. Let me give you another example. Chaim Maccabee, who's another Jew, argued in his paper on the question, and it's very emotional. He said this is an example of Marx's early anti-Semitism, despite the fact, of course, Marx is a Jew. According to Maccabee, Marx argues that the modern commercialized world is a triumph of Judaism, a pseudo-religion whose god is money. Maccabee suggested that Marx was embarrassed by his Jewish background and used Jews as a yardstick of evil, though he offers no evidence for this, and he doesn't even say if it's true or false. His paper is mostly an emotional rejection of any historical description of the Jews as powerful capitalists. Of course, it's emotional because there's no facts to be found. Again, if you claim to be anti-capitalist and you're not looking at the Jews, you're being dishonest. Werner Sombart helped me put all this into perspective, and his work, The Jews and Modern Capitalism, 1911, many of my listeners are familiar with it. I read it on a regular basis. Wealthiest Jews anywhere in Europe tended to either be Talmudic scholars or at least finance them. And here's what he says. The most learned Talmudists were also the cleverest financiers, medical men, jewelers, merchants. We are told, for example, that some of the Spanish ministers of finance, bankers, and court physicians, they devoted to the study of the Holy Writ, that is to say, Talmud, not only the Sabbath, but two nights of each week. And Sombart goes on to describe this. But there's an alchemy here. There's an intellectual alchemy that transformed Karl Marx into an anti-Semite, as well as a Jewish revolutionary. It seems odd, but you have to break free from the mainstream understanding of these things. Karl Marx, like the capitalists, saw himself as the apogee, the zenith of the Enlightenment, which dissolved all customs and religious beliefs. When applied to Christianity, we get secularization. It reduced Judaism to its essence, which is as a rejection of logos, culminating in revolution. The German Enlightenment, in other words, gave birth to the Jewish revolutionary mind in a nasty form when it made contact with the Jews who felt that their own religious tradition was discredited. From then on, Judaism with ethnicity, it had nothing to do with God, or assuming it ever had anything to do with God. Marx was part of the same process, 1830s, 1840s, which created the activists of the Jewish Enlightenment, the Maskilim, his father's generation in Prussia. The next step, of course, would transform the shadows of Western Russia into a hotbed of Jewish revolutionary activity, which would bring about, eventually, the USSR. So when the German Enlightenment made contact with Jews, it led in the first generation to assimilation, second generation, socialism. I borrowed some of that from Michael Jones, too. Christianity didn't dissolve, as Bauer had anticipated, into a universal human consciousness. It dissolved into the mercantile spirit of Judaism. That's the context in which Christians were equally capable of becoming emancipated like Jews are. It was a race to the bottom. There were entitled, egoistic, alienated individuals, purely negative freedom. They would attain true freedom only, of course, in liberation from Judaism. That is the precondition of huckstering. That's just another way of saying that the Jews took over the morals of society and perverted it in their direction. But you can't expect a Marxist revolution without having that amoral population to work on. I want to quote again from Marx's The Jewish Question. The Christian state can behave towards the Jew only in the way characteristic of a Christian state, that is, by granting privileges, by permitting the separation of the Jew from other subjects, by making him feel the pressure of all the other separate spheres of society, and feel it all the more intensely because he is in religious opposition to the dominant religion. But the Jew, too, can behave towards the state only in a Jewish way, that is, by treating it as something alien to him, by contraposing his imaginary nationality to the real nationality, by contraposing his illusory law to the real law, deeming himself justified in separating himself from mankind, by abstaining on principle from taking part in the historical movement, by putting his trust in a future which has nothing in common with the future of mankind in general, and by seeing himself as a member of the Jewish people as a chosen people. Now, that only works when someone like Bauer looks at Judaism only as a religious doctrine. There's still much truth there, though. The Jewish way is to see the goyim as themselves alien, that at the best need to be led to true enlightenment through revolution, or at worst, annihilated. The state in Germany was Lutheran, though the Jews, seeing themselves both as separate and superior, could only be granted privileges, not abstract rights. But since they functioned in civil society, not at the state level, it was also irrelevant. So Karl Marx asks, and I think this is part two of the Jewish question. He says, what constitutes liberty? He then quotes the French Revolutionary Rights of Man, Article 6. Liberty is the power which man has to do everything that does not harm the rights of others. Or, then of course, the Declaration of the Rights of Man in 1791, liberty consists in being able to do everything which does not harm others. So the bourgeois revolutionaries had a defective conception of freedom. Today, of course, we take that for granted. Everyone thinks that's what freedom is. It's just defined as an absence of restraint. But Marx and Bolsheviks in general refused to countenance the idea that it was the removal of Christian principles, that was the restraint, that permitted the explosion of greed that empowered the new class of capitalist oligarchs and created the misery of the working class. Marx continued, "The political revolution must overthrow this sovereign power in feudalism and raise state affairs to become the affairs of the people, which constituted the political state as a matter of general concern, that is, as a real state, necessarily smashed all estates, corporations, guilds, and privileges, since they were manifestations of the separation of the people from the community. The political revolution, French Revolution, thereby abolished the political character of civil society. It broke up civil society into its simple component parts. On the one hand, individuals, and on the other hand, the material and spiritual elements constituting the content of the life and social position of those individuals. It set free the political spirit, which had been, as it were, split up, partitioned, and dispersed into the various blind alleys of feudal society. But the completion of the idealism of the state was at the same time a completion of the materialism of civil society. Throwing off the political yoke meant at the same time throwing off the bonds which restrained the egoistic spirit of civil society." Now Marx is coming closer to the truth. Emancipation initially meant the overthrow of the French monarchy and the church that went with it. Marx also comes very close to the truth, saying that it is the destruction of the estates and the guilds that set free man's ego, which led to this Darwinian or the Hobbesian war of all against all. But that's a good thing in Marx's mind, because that's a necessary step in the road to revolution. The rights of man were just abstractions, but still it was a necessity for the time period. So Karl Marx puts it this way in the same paper. "Man was not freed from religion, he received religious freedom. He was not freed from property, he received freedom to own property. He was not freed from the egoism of business, he received freedom to engage in business." Socialism requires, at least initially, the active destruction of religion, not just its being banished to the private arena of civil society. Now, human emancipation doesn't have a state at all, and certainly doesn't talk about abstractions like rights. The removal of all barriers to free trade in commodities, of course, it applies to labor. Total freedom in the most ideal libertarian world in the labor market leads to competition among workers by necessity. The highest degree of general competition comes down to driving workers' wages down to the lowest possible level. That's the goal of free trade. It leads to pure misery, and that's why Karl Marx liked it, because that what he thought would lead to revolution. Freedom in this case is just a hoax. The worker can't hope to meet the owner of capital face to face. He doesn't even have labor unions anymore. The poor proletarian stands completely alone against the forces which capitalism has unleashed to destroy him. Now, I'm going to quote Marx's probably most infamous passage from the Jewish question. "Let us consider the actual worldly Jew, not the Sabbath religious Jew as Bauer does, but the everyday Jew. Let us not look for the secret of Jew in his religion, but let us look for the secret of his religion in the real Jew. What is the secular basis of Judaism? Practical need, self-interest. What is the worldly religion of Jew? Huckstering. What is his worldly God? Money. Organization of society would abolish the preconditions for huckstering, and therefore the possibility of huckstering would make the Jew impossible. We recognize in Judaism, therefore, a general antisocial element for the present time, an element which, through historical development, to which this harmful respect the Jews have zealously contributed, has been brought to the present high level, at which it must necessarily begin to disintegrate. In the final analysis, the emancipation of the Jews is the emancipation of mankind from Judaism. The Jew has emancipated himself in a Jewish manner, not only because he acquired financial power, but also because through him, and also apart from him, money has become a world power, and the practical Jewish spirit has become the practical spirit of the Christian nations too. The Jews have emancipated themselves insofar as the Christians have become Jews." And that's from part two. For Marx, then, Judaism inherently serves Mammon. because Jews have poisoned the Christian well, Christians have become materialists, or at least they've become hucksters themselves. Christians have become Jews. Emancipation just unleashes huckstering on society. Now, here's the other infamous quote from that, from the Jewish question by Marx. It gets quoted all the time. Monotheism of the Jew, therefore, is in reality polytheism of the many physical needs, a polytheism which makes even the laboratory an object of divine law, the Talmud. Practical need, egoism, is the principle of civil society, and as such appears in pure form as soon as civil society has fully given birth to the political state. The god of practical need and self-interest is money. Money is a jealous god of Israel, in face of which no other god may exist. Money degrades all the gods of man, turns them into commodities. Money is a universal, self-established value of all things. It has therefore robbed the whole world, the world of men and nature, of its specific value. Money is the estranged essence of man's work and man's existence, and this alien essence dominates the Jew, and he worships it. The God of the Jews has become secularized and has become the God of the world. The bill of exchange is a real God of the Jew. His God is only the illusory bill of exchange. The view of nature attained under the domination of private property and money is a real contempt for and practical debasement of nature. In the Jewish religion, nature exists, it's true, but it exists only in the imagination. Now, those two quotes get thrown around a lot without any real context or understanding. But Marx has shown here that Judaism is not a theological matter. It's not a relic of the past. But you even have some Jews who will say, you see how wonderful this is. Jews deserve civil rights because they were the carriers of the dynamic spirit of the present, the spirit of practical rationality and private gain. Without understanding that the Jews thus have just brought society down to its own level. Now emancipation just made sense. They made huckstering normal. Now the importance of Sombart for me here is in contextualizing what the non-Jewish European economy was. Huckstering, in the sense we normally use the term, was alien to the with the Europe of the Middle Ages. Now, what the Jews introduced are practices today taken for granted, but in years past totally unheard of. Dishonest competition, underselling, that was foreign to the cities of Northern Europe. And Sombart tries to summarize this. I'm going to quote it. It's very important. He's quoting, talking about the legislation of regulating trade in Christian societies, especially in Northern Europe. To take away your neighbor's customers was contemptible, unchristian, and immoral. A rule for merchants who trade in commodities was, turn no man's customers away from him, either by word, of mouth, or by letter. Do not do to another what you would not have done to you. It was, however, more than a rule. It became an ordinance, and is met with over and over again. In other places, the wording was as follows. No one should prevent another from buying, or by offering a higher price make a commodity more expensive, on pain of losing the purchase. No one shall interfere with another's business undertaking, or carry on his own, so large a scale as to ruin another. Saxony, it was the same thing. No shopkeeper should call away the customers from another shop, nor shall he by signs or motions keep them from buying. That's interesting. Even things like advertising were unheard of because it was considered unfair. Profit wasn't the goal. Stability and quality was. That was the ideal of European commerce. Sombart goes on and on quoting legislation from all over the place, saying the exact same things. He cites a huge number of local laws and statutes. But as the Jews became wealthier, more numerous, and more powerful, they began to uproot this system by their own example. That was Marx's response to power. That was the Jewish question. For Marx, the feudal age of which these laws are a relic of must give way to the mercantile, the capitalist. It was a necessary step in the revolution before socialism could ever be considered, and Jews were central to both transitions. It's important to understand how Jews revolutionized Europe. Jews were at the core of the new society of private gain, as Draper says. Again, I want to quote Sombart the mercantile world before Jewish domination, at least in its ideal form. Producer and trader should receive sufficient for their need. One outstanding result of this principle was strictly to circumscribe each man's activity in his locality. Competition was therefore quite out of the question. In his own sphere, a man might work as he willed. When, how, where, in accordance with tradition and custom. But to cast a look at your neighbor's sphere, he was forbidden to do. Just as a peasant receives his holding, so much field, pasture, and woodland, as would keep him and his family, just as he never dreamed of adding to his possessions, so too the craftsman and the merchant were to rest content with their portions and never covet their neighbors. The peasant had his land, the town dweller his customers. In either case, they were the source whence sprang his livelihood. In either case, they were of a size sufficient for the purpose. Hence, the trader had to be assured of his custom, and many were the ordinances which guarded him against competition, and that was the nature of commercial etiquette. Sombart says that, page 87 and 88. It's a non-acquisitive society at its root. Something happened to destroy that. A foreign and alien element came in and revolutionized the default settings that would destroy all of this. And it was the Jews and their Protestant creation. Karl Marx is very clear. He says that profit-seeking at the expense of another was a Jewish practice that quickly spread to the rest of society, as Sombart just said. In the Jewish question, part two, Marx says this: Christianity is a sublime thought of Judaism. Judaism is a common practical application of Christianity. But this application could only become general after Christianity as a developed religion had completed theoretically the estrangement of man from himself and from nature. Only then could Judaism achieve universal dominance and make alienated man and alienated nature into alienable, vendable, sellable objects, subject to the slavery of egoistic need and of trading. Selling is a practical aspect of alienation, just as man, so long as he's in the grip of religion, is able to objectify his essential nature only by turning it into something alien, something fantastic, so under the domination of egoistic need, he can be active practically, produce objects in practice, only by putting his products and his activity under the dominion of an alien being, bestowing the significance of an alien entity, money, on them. Now, it's a very, you know, he writes it in a typical Hegelian way. You know, you have to spend a lot of time understanding the verbiage. Of course, he's saying religion is inherently alienating because it involves a transferring of man's essence elsewhere, which comes from Feuerbach. The Jews didn't have that problem because its essence was money. That was the god of Judaism then and now. Once their dominance reached a critical mass, you had Protestantism, especially Calvinism, Puritanism. The scientific revolution coming from alchemy and the Kabbalah posited man as ruling nature, not being a part of it. Jews took control of Christianity to a great extent through their revolution of Calvin and the Puritans. Here, Marx says in the same essay, "In its preferred practice, Christian egoism of heavenly bliss is necessarily transformed into the corporeal egoism of the Jew. Heavenly need is turned into world need, subjectivism into self-interest. We explain the tenacity of the Jew not by his religion, but on the contrary, by the human basis of his religion, practical need, egoism. Since in civil society the real nature of the Jew has been universally realized and secularized, civil society could not convince the Jew of the unreality of his religious nature, which is indeed only the ideal aspect of practical need." Now, Karl Marx can say this because at the time, Judaism was still seen as a theology. Marx came to realize that once that was abandoned, the Jew can come out of his separation and then dominate the society, creating the conditions for what Engels would call the immiseration of the worker. Marx knew that the Jewish religion had zero resemblance to the Old Testament, which banned usury and mercantilism. It was based on the later Babylonian Talmud and several other sources. The Talmud, though, what he's arguing is that came from the Jews' economic position and needs. It should remain in spirit, but the endless traditions and laws that it produces, that is not necessary. See, the reason why so many Jews in academia will condemn this essay as anti-Semitic is because it's accurate. It describes the Machiavellian economic thought of actions of the Jews among Gentiles. the overwhelmingly Jewish authors who deal with this paper can't really contain their emotion quite often, so their evidence, as mentioned above, is quite scarce. Yet, history remains. The Jew challenged the moral economy of Christian Europe, introducing competitive elements taken for granted today. Now, how did the Jews do this? Well, that could take many, many books. E. Michael Jones has done a wonderful job in Barron Metal and a few other places. But here's what Sombart has to say about it. Now, in a community where quality was regulated, the only effective means of achieving this end, that is, of economic dominance, was price cutting. We shall therefore not be surprised to find Jews availing themselves of this weapon. We shall see that it was just this that made them so disliked among Christian traders, whose economic outlook was all for maintaining prices. The Jew undersells. The Jew spoils prices. The Jew tries to attract customers by low prices. That was the burden of the complaints heard in the 17th and 18th centuries wherever Jews did business, with no exceptions. Underselling was the most common complaint. It was unknown prior to that. The guild system wouldn't tolerate it. The very notion that a seller or a manufacturer would try to destroy the business of others was outrageous. Christian men, by natural law, had the right and the duty to earn a living by honest labor. But by the time Charles Darwin justified the survival of the fittest, it became the norm. Sombart again. The Swedish Parliament in 1815 debated the question whether the Jews should be allowed entire liberty of trade. And one of the chief reasons which prevailed against the motion was that Jews lower prices. From Poland, the same strange reaches. Jews tell Christian traders that if they, the latter, sold their goods as cheaply as Jews, they too would attract customers. It's no different in Germany. In Brandenburg, 1672, Frankfurt, 17th century, from Magdeburg, 1710, the same story is repeated. A Wallachian traveler in Germany at the same time reports the ubiquity of this accusation. The General Prussian Edict of 1750 talks about it. The merchants of our towns complain that the Jewish traders who sell the same good do them great harm because they sell at a lower price. Right up until the 19th century, it's still met with. The supplication of the Augsburg wholesale merchants against the admission of the Jews in 1803. It says, the Jews understand how to derive advantages from the general depression of trade. They obtain goods from people who need money badly at shameful prices, and then spoil the market by selling them at a cheaper rate. In many branches of industry, the Christian manufacturers and merchants, even today, regard the cutting of prices by Jews as a serious endangering of their trade. That this is an open secret and often enough discussed is well known. Well, it may have been well known in 1911. No one's allowed to talk about it in 2025. In essence, evil drove out the good because being good was difficult. The moral economy gave way to capitalism and free trade, two necessary stages before the Jewish left could take over entirely in socialism. The ego was set free. Passions were given free rein and called freedom. It's a big problem when Marx is talking like this. Someone of his stature, admitting Jewish economic dishonesty, that this is normal. I know I just quoted Sombart, but Marx says the same thing. You really don't know what to do with it. They either dismiss it as anti-Semitic raving, he was you know, mentally ill or whatever, or try to interpret it way beyond the meaning of the text. But the question is pretty normal. And it comes up right away. How could they do this? Underselling. How can they do this? Well, first, these goods were taken by dishonest means. In Russia, the Jews were expert smugglers. They functioned in Russia essentially as a mafia organization. As the Sombart quote mentions, some of their goods came from fire sales after a debtor had been liquidated. Even beyond that, another complaint said the goods peddled by the Jews were of inferior quality, using advertising and PR to manipulate the buyer. Wherever they'd been found, they operated as a criminal mafia. The only thing that kept that from being known is their control over the press and the legal profession, all brought about by, quote, political emancipation. But the Jews have a big problem, because some of the greatest founders of the left, leftist movements, all said the same thing about them. Bakunin, Mikhail Bakunin, one of the founders of anarchism, along with Proudhon and Kropotkin, Bakunin was one of the fathers of anarchism. He wrote in his Study on the German Jew, The Jewish sect constitutes a venerable power in Europe. It reigns despotically in commerce and banking and has invaded 3/4 of German journalism and very considerable part of the journalism of other countries. Then woe to him who makes the mistake of displeasing it. That was quoted disapprovingly by Draper. It's also a correct assessment. Bakunin realized that Marx and Engels were on the Rothschild payroll. Marx was financed by elite sources outside elite sources in Britain, making a mockery of his theory, by the way, which stated that such cooperation was impossible. Again, if an activist truly believes in equality or socialism, you can't ignore the Jews. But the founders of the great leftist schools in the 19th century did not avoid the Jewish question. Again, Bakunin says this in 1871. Himself a Jew, Marx has around him in London and France, but especially in Germany, a multitude of more or less clever, intriguing, mobile, speculating Jews, such as Jews are everywhere, commercial, banking agents, writers, politicians, correspondents for newspapers of all types, one foot in the bank, the other in the socialist movement. But they're behind, sitting on the German daily press. They have taken possession of all newspapers. You can imagine what kind of sickening literature they produce. Now this entire Jewish world, which forms a single profiteering sect, bloodsuckers, gluttonous parasites, closely and intimately united not only across national borders, but across all differences of political opinion. The Jewish world today stands for the most part at the disposal of Marx, and at the same time, at Rothschild. This may seem strange. What could there be in common between communism and the large banks? The communism of Marx seeks enormous centralization in the state. And where such exists, there must inevitably be a central state bank. And where a state bank exists like this, the parasitic Jewish nation, which speculates on the work of the people, will always find a way to prevail. Now, that sort of language terrifies Jewish intellectuals. This is one of the founders of anarchism here. Their leftist credentials are pristine. I think leftist anti-Semitism is a Jew's nightmare. In the USSR, for example, oligarchs like the Ginsburg family that controlled the infamous Lena gold mines were granted high positions after the revolution. Suddenly, they became proletarians despite being able to keep their millions and millions of rubles, proving what those terms really meant, proving what Marxism and the USSR really were. Now, anarchism, also to a great extent a Jewish ideology, is absurd. It's like determinism or materialism. It's just a negation. It has nothing upon which to build a new society. It's largely a handful of Jewish intellectuals with these edgy teens on the street burning cars because of racism. But the truth is, any weakening of a central power anywhere means that oligarchs and local strongmen take over, not the people. This is an iron law. Collapse of the state leads to a far worse form of dominion and oligarchy. This has been seen all over the globe under many differing circumstances. But of course, Marxism has the same problem. National socialism has actually produced a labor-based society, while your typical Marxian socialist did not. National socialism, where it was tried, in few places it's been tried, did what the left only promised. Now I want to quote Moses Hess, the man who brought together Jewish nationalism and internationalist socialism. He wrote a paper in 1845, 1 year after Marx wrote The Jewish Question, The Essence of Money. He says this: the Jews had the world historic mission, the natural history of the social animal world, of developing the beast of prey out of man. They have finally fulfilled their mission. The mystery of Judaism and Christianity has been made public in the modern Jewish Christian world of shopkeepers. The mystery of the blood of Christ, like the mystery of the old Jewish blood cult, whatever that means, appears here finally completely unveiled as a mystery of the beast of prey. In the modern Jewish Christian world of shopkeepers, this bent and drive of the social animal world no longer comes out either symbolic or mystic, but totally prosaic. In the face of money, kings are no longer entitled to conquer as the lions of the animal men. Rather, they only have the right, like the other animal men, arising from common natural right, from their common quality of beasts of prey, bloodsuckers, Jews, money wolves. Now, I don't know what he means by the old Jewish blood cult. Sometimes I wonder if he's talking about ritual murder. anyway, in a very twisted way, and he was a twisted man, he equates the Eucharist with its very negation, the sacrifice of workers to the industrial machine. But he's more than aware that Christianity had nothing to do with it. Like Marx, Hess only refers to Christians as a group that had already been remade by Jewish power. They're not theological terms. The competitive and Darwinian spirit is a creation of the Jews. And as he says here, their role is to reduce all men to the animal level. Well, animals can be trained. And only then can socialism be built. When the socialists talk about the masses, they're referring to these animalistic, bloodthirsty men. Labor has nothing to do with it. Labor is a cheap prop to justify their takeover. And the takeover of society by hucksters. What about the great B.J. Prudhomme? A great writer. He is the man who coined the term anarchism and anarchist. He coined the phrase, property is theft. Here's what he says about the Jews. Now, what I'm going to quote here is only a note to himself. It wasn't, you know, meant to be published. You know, he's reminding him, you know, he wrote something down like in his diary to remind himself in the future. Write an article against this race that poisons everything by sticking its nose into everything without ever mixing with any other people. Demand its expulsion from France with the exception of those individuals married to French women. Abolish synagogues. Do not admit them to any employment. Demand their expulsion. Pursue the abolition of this religion. It is not without cause that the Christians call them deicides. The Jew is the enemy of mankind. They must be sent back to Asia or exterminated. Heine, Weil, and others are nothing but secret spies. Rothschild, Cremieux, Marx, Fold, wicked, envious, bitter. They are beings who hate us. The Jew must disappear by steal or by fusion or by expulsion. Tolerate the elderly who no longer have children. This is the work to be done. What the peoples of the Middle Ages hated instinctively, I hate upon reflection and irrevocably. The hatred of the Jew, like the hatred of the English, should be our first article of political faith. I like that. Moreover, the abolition of Judaism will come with the abolition of other religions too. Begin not by allocating funds for the clergy and leaving this to religious offerings, and then, a short while later, abolish the religion entirely. Those are extremely harsh words. He talks about extermination. This is one of the founders of anarchism, December 26, 1847. So what does that mean? That means four of the most important leaders by far of the socialist left in the 19th century, Proudhon, Marx, Hess, and Bakunin, all come to the same conclusions regarding the role of the Jews in capitalism and their takeover of public morals. So the monarchists were just essentially repeating their statements. Now, for Hess and Marx, their way ahead was to increase the power of the money wolves, reduce the proletariat to hopeless poverty, then take advantage of that alienation and take over this mass of animals entirely. Prudhomme understood what the Jewish mind truly was. He did not want to talk about any kind of emancipation. In fact, Prudhomme even came close to defining anarchism as freedom from usury. Bakunin, who was a Luciferian, wasn't too far off. He was also concerned with Jews' control over the International. Marx, of course, had both Proudhon and Bakunin thrown out of the First International in a nasty fit of rage, described in Paul Johnson's book, Intellectuals. In other words, Marx's The Jewish Question comes down to the destruction of Christianity that is required for the socialist revolution to take place. Free trade and capitalism, Jewish huckstering, has to happen before there could be any proletarian revolution. And that, for Marx, is what he means by human emancipation. Today, the postmodern left, the dominant ideology of the regime, has totally abandoned the working class. They finally dropped the facade of labor equality, proving it was all fake to begin with. Oligarchy was considered acceptable to them, since the wealthy were promoting their sexual and racial policies. Non-whites, fags, tranny freaks, the homosexuals, they took the place of the proletariat and leftist thinking, driven both by the universities and the media. The left will not tolerate even the slightest mention of the huge number of Jews that control finance, capital, and speculation in the U.S. I'm not sure why, other than racism or something. Their entire stance on this is special pleading. Today's Jews and leftist professors in general have become intellectually soft because they've never had to answer any question as to whether or not this is true. anti-Semitism somehow as an argument in and of itself. In the EU, you go to prison for even mentioning it. In the mainstream economic world, Jewish academics, public intellectuals, never have to worry about refuting any of this stuff. They never hear them. They only know them through caricature. This means that they're not only intellectually lazy, hiding behind their walls of law enforcement and censorship, but they also have an extremely narrow view of the world around them. They assume their ideology is incontrovertible fact, since they have access to no other. Unfortunately, historical reality doesn't bend that easily. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I appreciate it, and I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.